Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Tanzania, President Obama's last leg on his African trip, where he signed an executive order to prevent the slaughter of rhinos and elephants for their horns and tusks. Jeanette Hemley, Senior Vice President of Conservation Strategy and Science at the World Wildlife Fund, joins us to discuss the conflicting agendas of developing Tanzania's gas fields and building more roads that will lead to more poaching, adding to the toll of the 10,000 elephants killed in Tanzania last year. Then we'll get an update on the deteriorating situation in Egypt, where the military have given President Morsi 48 hours to bring together a country that his Muslim Brotherhood government has bitterly divided. Sama Shahata, a professor of Middle East politics at the University of Oklahoma, joins us to discuss the growing protests organized by Tamarod, the rebellion, whose petition has 22 million signatures calling for Morsi to step down and for fresh elections to follow. Then finally, with the American fugitive Edward Snowden having applied for political asylum in Russia, we will talk to a prominent whistleblower about how civil liberties and national security can be balanced. Colleen Rowley, a former FBI special agent who pushed for an investigation of the so-called 13th 9/11 hijacker, joins us to discuss Putin's announcement that if Snowden wants to stay here, there is one condition. He must cease his work aimed at inflicting damage on our American partners, as strange as it may sound coming from my lips. And joining us now is Jeanette Hemley, Senior Vice President of Conservation Strategy and Science at the World Wildlife Fund, where she tracks execution of the World Wildlife Fund's local to global strategy to conserve ecologically important places and leads conservation advocacy campaigns to advance the World Wildlife Fund's global agenda and strengthen international policies to protect endangered and threatened species. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeanette Hemley.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And the president, on his trip to Tanzania, the last stop on his visit to Africa, he has signed an executive order aimed at preventing wildlife trafficking, particularly in rhinoceros horns and elephant tusks. And obviously, this is something that's been concerning you for some time. Where do we stand in terms of the exploitation, the slaughter and poaching of elephants in particular for their ivory? My understanding is that it's increased exponentially, and in the last year or so, it's been an absolute slaughter.
Well, it has been a huge conservation concern for the last few years, and you're right. The last couple of years, we've seen an explosion of poaching in Central Africa of elephants. We're seeing large shipments leaving Africa through the western part of the continent, as well as now through East Africa. It is a trend that is extremely worrying. And after a number of years where things were fairly stable in parts of Africa, we are suddenly seeing a big turn for the worse for the elephant.
Well, my understanding is that what's at issue in Tanzania more than anything else is this on-again, off-again Serengeti Highway that would link the Indian Ocean coast to Lake Victoria and then on to Uganda, Rwanda, and the Congo. My understanding is that the mining lobbies in Tanzania for the gold mines and the soda ash industry, they want this road opened up. But conservationists believe and are concerned that the increased traffic is going to devastate migration patterns for wildebeests and elephants and et cetera, and of course open up the Serengeti to even more poaching.
You know, that's one of the big challenges we have. Certainly that highway and highways like it in Central Africa that are being opened up by Chinese investments with billions of dollars pouring into from China and some other countries to extract the resources in unsustainable ways. All of these roads and the Serengeti Highway is chief among them could really just bring the access to wildlife that much closer closer to, you know, to the poachers, and that is certainly one of the big issues. You know, it underscores, you know, a huge challenge that we have, you know, just a sort of across the spectrum. There are a number of issues. You've got demand for wildlife products in countries particularly like China, but also Thailand for ivory. Those are the two countries that are the biggest markets for ivory right now. That, you know, we've got growing middle class, buying power in those countries, and the ivory trade in those markets is booming. And so that's driven a lot of the trends in poaching that we're now seeing. And that coupled with, you know, things like opening up access through the development of roads is just exacerbating the situation.
Well, in terms of the slaughter of elephants for their tusks, my understanding is that 10,000 elephants are being killed for their tusks annually across Tanzania, more than any other country in Africa.
That, you know, I'm not aware of that number. Do you say 10,000 in Tanzania?
Well, maybe that's a cumulative effect, that the elephant population in Tanzania has apparently fallen from 2,500 to just 500 in recent years. Is that right? Or is that just a Serengeti?
That's just the Serengeti, I think. I mean, it's continent-wide in 2012, about an estimated 30,000 elephants were poached, and that's probably a minimum number. Most of those elephants coming out of Central Africa, where we have the least information about the status of elephants, but we know that the numbers are going down precipitously. We have the weakest enforcement in that region, and so the largest problem with illegal trade. Tanzania, parts of Tanzania, the Serengeti is one area that's gotten hit. The Selu has gotten hit very hard, another important protected area in Tanzania. And so you're seeing elephants getting hit in Tanzania directly. And Tanzania has also become a critical transit country for ivory from other parts of Africa. So Tanzania is part of this picture in several ways, and, you know, is certainly in the crosshairs of the trade. And thus, it was important to see hear the president in Tanzania today announcing this big new commitment, including to helping the Tanzanian government deal with the issue in a newly concerted way.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeanette Henley, who is the Senior Vice President for Conservation Strategy and Science at the World Wildlife Fund, where she tracks execution of the World Wildlife Fund's local to global strategy to conserve ecologically important places and protect endangered and threatened species. Now, give us a sense of what this initiative does that the President is talking about in terms of money and enforcement. I mean, I take it that if you know where the elephants are being killed, if you know where the ivory is being transported, and if you know what ports from which they are exported to, you were saying that Thailand and China are the big markets for ivory, you would think that from a law enforcement point of view, it may not be that difficult to deal with. So what are the problems? Why has there been such an open season on the slaughter of elephants for the last few years?
Yep. So it's a number of things. So the significance of the president's announcement is that he is elevating for the first time at that level, to the highest office of the United States, the issue of wildlife trafficking. And it's the challenge that we've had in the conservation community and at World Wildlife Fund for the last few years is this problem has grown, the response to it has not in the sense of government response. So President Obama has made this a top priority for his administration, which is very significant. He's called together his cabinet officials to come up with a strategic response by the U.S. government in the next few months to chart out how we can help countries in Africa and other parts of the world, but particularly Africa, beef up enforcement, crack down on illegal trade, help countries with capacity to do that. I mean, you're right. On the face of it, you'd think, you know, if we know where the ivory's going, it might be relatively easy to tackle it and track it better and interdict it, but that's not been the case. And part of the reason is because the wildlife trade, while it used to be more of an ad hoc kind of opportunistic activity by the random poacher and illegal trader, it's now become a highly organized criminal activity running through crime syndicates, often linked to insurgent groups in Africa, highly sophisticated, highly organized. And so that's the challenge we're up against, and that's why it's important that this crime be treated like a serious crime along the lines of other big trade, illegal trade problems like narcotics and human trafficking and counterfeiting. You know, in fact, the illegal wildlife trade on a global scale is valued at somewhere between $7 and $10 billion a year. That's billion. And that puts it right up there as one of the top four or five illegal trades in the world in terms of scope and value. And so it's actually a very significant criminal activity and needs to be treated as such. And President Obama has today announced that it will be treated as a serious crime, and that's a big breakthrough.
And Jeanette Hemley, if indeed the organized crime and rebel groups and insurgent groups are involved in the poaching and slaughter of elephants and rhinoceroses, poaching of their tusks and selling them, now you would think that just giving some money to train some, you know, rangers to go in there lightly armed, that's not a fair fight by the sound of it.
You know, I mean, that's a good point. It's going to take more than just straight enforcement. In fact, another initiative that's underway in the U.S. government is a full review by the National Intelligence Council of the links of the wildlife trade to insurgencies and other illicit activities. And so it is much more than just, you know, an enforcement problem. And so together, these responses that the United States is making now, we hope to really get at the problem. It's really going to take a multifaceted effort. And through this presidential task force that President Obama has set up today, we hope that all the resources of the U.S. government from across the various agencies, from the State Department to the Interior Department to the Homeland Security Department and the Justice Department, we can really get a better picture of how to provide the best response to countries in the greatest need.
So in terms of the insurgencies, the most unstable place, of course, is the Congo and the bordering states, Rwanda and Uganda. In effect, the genocide in Rwanda opened a wound that still continues to bleed. Is that where the destabilization is coming from? I'm not aware of too many insurgencies, and certainly not in Tanzania or in Kenya. There's tribal bloodshed going on, and the president of Kenya is wanted by the International Criminal Court for running death squads. But apart from that, where do you think the problem lies, or where are the origins? Because Mugabe is one of the worst actors, I understand, in financing blood diamonds and destabilizing some of the neighborhoods.
Well, you're right that the Central Africa in particular is the area where we're seeing these security threats and the instabilities. The United Nations Security Council issued a report last month, in fact, that documented that the Lord's Resistance Army, the LRA, run by the infamous Kony, has actually been linked to the illegal ivory trade and to poaching activities. They're essentially selling ivory to finance their activities. Kony and the LRA are now thought to be in the Central African Republic. In that region, of course, in Uganda has been, you know, a country that has been of concern, and that the U.S. has cooperated with to try to address some of the problems of this insurgency. So that's certainly a hot spot, and the U.N. Has recently taken a great interest in this to really try to understand more specifically where the insurgencies are linked in. It seems as though arms are coming from the fallout of the Libyan situation. And there's just a growing amount of weapons and arms available in Africa from, you know, all the different civil wars and insurgent problems that have taken place over many years. And that's all just making, you know, poaching that much easier to undertake. And so that's another compounding factor.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeanette Hemley, who is the Senior Vice President of Conservation Strategy and Science at the World Wildlife Fund, where she executes their local two global strategy to conserve ecologically important places and protect endangered and threatened species. Now, the president today in Tanzania is going to be opening a U.S.-owned power plant following an announcement over the weekend of a multi-billion-dollar electricity initiative. And my understanding is, in terms of value for money, in terms of helping Africa, as opposed to exploiting it, which is what the colonial powers have been doing for centuries, would be to improve infrastructure because, you know, people's electricity goes on and off all the time throughout Africa, and roads and infrastructure do limit Africa's ability to export. But it's a sort of a double-edged thing, isn't it, in a way, because Tanzania has an estimated 41.7 trillion cubic feet of recoverable natural gas reserves, and discoveries offshore of Tanzania and Mozambique have led oil and gas people to predict that it could be the world's third largest exporter of natural gas. So, you know, we've seen what's happened in the United States with this mania over fracking, and we talked earlier about the Serengeti Highway. So if you're going to be, on the one hand, protecting the elephants and the rhinoceros and the wildebeest, but on the other hand, encouraging development of oil and gas and the infrastructure that that would bring in with highways, et cetera, don't those two things work against each other?
Well, they certainly can if they're not done right. I think what the president intends and other countries that are trying to help Africa develop in a good way. Obviously, you know, we want to see more access to electricity in Tanzania and other countries, but it needs to be done in the right way, and with those countries to ensure that their natural resources are managed, in a proper way. So you're right. I mean, a lot comes into play. We certainly want to see increased investments in protecting the natural resources and the wildlife, and that's why this presidential initiative announced today for illegal wildlife trafficking is so important. But it's part of a package of new initiatives the president announced in Tanzania, all of which are aimed at helping both the country of Tanzania develop in the way it would like to, while also protecting and managing well its natural resources. So it's you've got to look at the whole package and work together with the countries to make sure that they that we're holding them accountable for the investments that we make, but also understanding their needs to reduce poverty and help develop properly.
Well, I've just been going through some notes here, Jeanette. And it's apparently here, well, there were 10,000 elephants killed for their tusk annually across Tanzania, a third of the global population. And the buffalo population in the Serengeti has dropped from 70,000 to 40,000 due to the demand for bushmeat. So that's a whole other aspect, is it not, bushmeat?
You know, the bushmeat issue is a very challenging one, and it is it's challenging because it's a lot of it's for local consumption and people need protein, and it's also for trade externally sometimes as well, it's a challenging one that it's going to take a lot of close working together with these countries and their local communities to really address that. And it's not one that we, I think, or any country in Africa has cracked yet. It's having a big impact as well as the commercial ivory trade, the large-scale ivory trade and rhinoceros horn trade that was the main subject of the president's announcement today.
Well, let's end on a positive note, Jeanette. What's your takeaway from the president talking about wanting a new model for development in Africa and choosing Tanzania to make that announcement?
I think, Tanzania has been a great country as a partner for the U.S. for many, many years, and that was reflected in the comments that the president made today with the president of Tanzania. It's a country that is obviously hugely important for its wildlife resources, and we're thrilled that the president announced in Tanzania this unprecedented commitment to really elevating the issue of illegal wildlife trafficking, which is the biggest threat to a number of iconic species, including elephants and rhinos. And we think it's a major step forward and a big signal to the world that the U.S. is going to take this issue seriously. We hope it will inspire other leaders around the world to step up and make similar commitments. And we really look forward to working with the Obama administration to helping them implement it so that we can all work together with the African countries to protect their precious wildlife species.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jeanette Hamley.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeanette Hemley, who's the Senior Vice President of Conservation Strategy and Science at the World Wildlife Fund, where she leads the local to global strategy to conserve ecologically important places and protect endangered and threatened species. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back doing an update on Egypt, where the military have given the Morsi government 48 hours to get their act together.
Hi, I'm Antonio Gonzalez from Strategy Session. In accordance with the Pacifica mission promoting a lasting understanding between nations and between the individuals of all nations, races, creeds, and colors, KPFK Radio would like to make listeners aware of the campaign to remove Cuba from the U.S. list of nations sponsoring terrorism. A petition to President Obama to remove Cuba from the terrorist list is available now at www.log.org. That's www.log.org.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Samer Shahada, who's a professor of Middle East politics at the University of Oklahoma. He's the author of Shop Floor, Culture and Politics in Egypt, and his most recent book is Islamist Politics in the Middle East, Movements and Change. Welcome to Background Briefing, Samer Shahada.
Thanks for having me.
And Egypt's top generals today, Monday, gave President Mohamed Morsi 48 hours to respond to these weeks of protests, which culminated yesterday with millions in Tahrir Square, declaring that if he didn't respond or settle the issue, then the military leaders themselves would impose their own roadmap to resolve this political crisis. What does that mean? I mean, it sounds like a little bit like SCAFE, the Supreme Council for the Armed Forces, is back in business or will be back in business if they're ever out of business.
Not exactly. Certainly, the Minister of Defense now is very different than the previous one, much younger. He hasn't been Minister of Defense for 25 years and is not necessarily Mubarak crony. But you're certainly correct that it is a threat, certainly, to Mr. Morsi. It would mean the military being more involved in politics, possibly even in front of the curtain as opposed to behind the curtain, as it has been, and so on. And in one sense, although one can understand why they would make a statement like this, it would also subvert the democratic process, meaning that it would potentially remove a democratically elected president through non-constitutional means. So there are many things going on. Certainly it's a form of pressure applied to Mr. Morsi to make concessions and to some kind of a compromise with the opposition. At the same time, there is now no incentive for the opposition to compromise with Mr. Morsi. I can imagine that from their perspective, if they simply waited out for 48 hours, the military will intervene, remove or sideline Mr. Morsi in a way, and some kind of a roadmap, as they've called it, would proceed.
I guess that opinion is reflected in a statement from Al-Aswani, the prominent Egyptian writer, who basically said, enough is enough. It has been decided for Mr. Morsi. Now we are waiting for him to understand. And that sort of contempt, I think, indicates the problem that so many Egyptians have with Morsi is that he is autocratic and dictatorial and somewhat boneheaded, even though he keeps talking about the wisdom that's coming forth from him. I understand that the final speech he made was not replete with wisdom, but basically was a rehash of, you know, old Muslim Brotherhood canards and nostrums.
Well, I would certainly agree that boneheaded is one way to characterize him. Certainly stubborn, divisive, incompetent leadership, and autocratic tendencies. But we can't go too far and equate his rule with Mr. Mubarak's rule, which some people have been, in Egypt and elsewhere, have been quick to do. And you're right that the speech certainly wasn't effective. That is, the speech that he made several days ago to the Egyptian people wasn't effective at somehow absorbing anger and so on and discouraging those to go out, nor was it effective in the sense that it provided some incentives for opposition figures in the National Salvation Front or the rebel movement or the June 30th movement to try to sit at a table with him and negotiate something. And, of course, they have quite legitimate concerns, and that is he's talked about concessions and negotiation in the past, and he's really been willing to do very little of that. So why should they return to the negotiating table? And certainly the crisis is largely of Mr. Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood's making. Now, blame does need to go around to others as well, but certainly the condition that Egypt is in now, and many people don't realize that there are and have been diesel shortages. There have been gasoline shortages with people having to wait in line for hours. There have been electricity shortages. The economy is deteriorating and so on. And hardly any, if any, of the pledges and promises that Mr. Morsi made when he first came to office of restoring security, of cleaning up the streets, and that is getting the garbage off the streets and so on, none of those things have really materialized. Of course, Egypt has had problems for many, many years, and not all of it is Mr. Morsi's fault, but he has not delivered on what he promised, and that's one of the reasons why regular people who aren't necessarily involved in politics are angered.
Again, I'm speaking with Samer Shahata, who is a professor of Middle East politics at the University of Oklahoma and the author of Shop Floor, Culture and Politics in Egypt. And his most recent book is Islamist Politics in the Middle East, Movements and Change. Well, it would seem that Mr. Morsi's options are somewhat limited. He could, you know, if he's not told to do so by the military, he could cut short his term, resign, call for early elections, or he could share power with the opposition and maybe become prime minister or something like that. Or I think the most likely option would be to try and rally his supporters to take to the streets. And we've seen pictures of them in kind of homemade paramilitary gear with helmets and shields, etc., and clubs. That's the worst prospect, is it not?
Well, none of the prospects are good, but I think you're right if Mr. Morsi reads the situation properly. Perhaps the best outcome now with the cards that he's been dealt from the military are a call for early elections. And if he were not to run for election, if they wanted to, another Muslim Brotherhood candidate could run. I don't suspect that they would win, but that in some senses might be the best outcome at this stage. Now, of course, that's different than a day or two ago when his best possible outcome, I think, could have been remaining in power for the remainder of his term, three more years, and so on. So nothing looks very good right now for Mr. Morsi or the Muslim Brotherhood or his Freedom and Justice Party. At the same time, there is something important to be said that sometimes gets lost in this, which is that there will never be a stable Egyptian politics without the inclusion of the Muslim Brotherhood in politics as a political player. Not their domination of politics, but their inclusion. And so any attempt to exclude them from politics is certain to lead to political instability. And that's also another dilemma that needs to be worked out in the coming days, weeks, and months, with a military intervention and a new roadmap, as it were, for Egypt.
Well, the opposition group, Tamarod Rebellion, they have gathered 22 million signatures calling for Morsi to step down. They have just, following the army's ultimatum of 48 hours for Morsi to get his act together, they're proclaiming now that the army is sided with the people. You mentioned, Samar Shahada, the possibility of another Muslim candidate running if Morsi were to call for new elections to take place soon. Wasn't there a more liberal Muslim Brotherhood candidate who didn't make it, along with a fairly popular socialist candidate who came real close to making it in the last elections?
Well, that's right. And in fact, the person you have in mind is a gentleman by the name of Abdul Min'im Abu Futuh. And he was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood up until several years ago. In fact, he was one of the leaders, kind of the progressive wing of the organization, up until he resigned or was forced to resign because he decided to run for president against the position of the organization at the time. He's considered by many, not all, to be much more liberal, much more progressive, possibly sincere about equal citizenship for all and so on. And I think there is some truth to that, you know, having met him a number of times and following some of his writings and so on. Now, he's potentially somebody who could serve as a bridge, and that is have some support among some Islamists and so on. And also, I think he would be someone who would be unwilling to repress the Muslim Brotherhood completely in an exclusionary fashion that would, I think, be damaging. But at the same time, there would be some in the Egyptian center, some liberal and so on support for him. But of course, one never knows who could emerge. Other people are more divisive and so on. And of course, all of this is contextually specific. I mean, after what we've seen the last few days, someone who might not normally win in a general election could emerge as a president, if that were to be the case. But again, I don't think there's going to be, as part of this new roadmap, a call for presidential elections, you know, in the short term. I don't think that's something that the military is likely to do. It might be 6 months or something like that before we see presidential elections in Egypt again.
So what about the parliament? They don't appear to be effective. They're dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood, and you suggested that the Muslim Brotherhood is considerably less popular than they were before because of Morsi's misrule. And the second biggest bloc in the parliament, of course, are the Salafists, who came out of nowhere. And the Salafis apparently have been funded by Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And they're, you know, responsible for some of the murder of the Shias the other day. They're really hardcore theocrats, aren't they?
Yes, many of them are. And, you know, to be precise, the lower house of parliament, the more important house of parliament, was dissolved by a judicial order some time ago. So what we have now is the upper house of parliament, the Shura Council, which really isn't representative of anything. I mean, it hasn't historically been important in the past. It couldn't actually propose legislation. It was more had an advisory role, and that's why only about 5% of the registered voters turned out to vote in the election to elect those people. And now, because of the situation and because the lower house was disbanded by judicial order, they find themselves as a legislature in this awkward, strange position. And you're right, they are dominated by Islamists. So I think, and you know, one of the things that has become clear over the last few weeks, but certainly from yesterday's protests, is the idea that Islamists necessarily dominate politics and are hegemonic across the Middle East is wrong. It's flawed. There are a diversity of viewpoints. There's pluralism within the Islamist political camps. You've mentioned yourself the Salafists. We've talked about this other gentleman who was a breakaway person from the Muslim Brotherhood, who's a bit more progressive. So that being said, Islamism isn't going to go away, and any elections in the future, parliamentary or presidential elections, are likely to have some Islamist candidates present.
And you mentioned, Shlomo Sihada, the defense minister, General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. He's a younger guy. He's not a part of the older defense establishment, but the defense establishment is so entrenched. They have their own industries. They continually funded by the U.S. as a result of the Camp David agreement. And my understanding is that the U.S. ambassador in Cairo has not been particularly effective and managed to alienate a lot of people there by giving the perception that she supports the Muslim Brotherhood government. And, of course, on the street, amongst the kind of conspiracy theories on the street, a lot of people apparently believe the U.S. is responsible for putting the Muslim Brotherhood in. My understanding is if the U.S. has any close ties at all, it's with the Egyptian military.
Well, that's correct, and it's a historical relationship, as you mentioned, as a result of the Camp David Accords. The United States is committed to providing about $1.3 billion to the Egyptian military annually, and there have been close ties, and of course there's also joint military exercises. In fact, they're going to happen, I believe, in a few months at Bright Star and so on. And there are military purchases and all kinds of things. So, yes, certainly the United States sees the military and has seen the military as friendly and interlocutor and so on, essential for American interests in the region, whatever that may be, you know, the maintenance of the Egyptian-Israeli peace accords and other kinds of things. And there has been criticism of Ambassador Ann Patterson, some of it justified, some of it not so justified. And I don't think anybody who knows the situation could really come to the legitimate conclusion that the United States installed Mr. Morsi or the Muslim Brotherhood as president. That's not the case. But at the time, the United States was calling for votes to be counted and for the winner to be announced based on the number of votes. And I think that happened to be Mr. Morsi as opposed to the other person. And of course, because the military assistance has continued, and because American leaders have met Mr. Morsi in Cairo, although he has not met Mr. Obama here at the White House, which is something that he's wanted to do, people in Egypt, critical of the Brotherhood, get the impression that this is support for the Muslim Brotherhood. And of course, the answer to that, I think, on the side of American officials, rightly or wrongly, is no, you know, we're supporting the legitimately elected government and president of Egypt. But you're certainly right that perhaps principles of equal citizenship and so on have not been emphasized enough by, to some extent, by American officials.
But conspiracy theories are fairly pervasive, are they not, on the street, if you will, in both the Arab Middle East and in Iran in particular. The Iranians, for example, apparently majority blame the U.S. for imposing the Ayatollahs on them, for choosing the Ayatollahs from one dictatorship to another, which I don't think was the case. I think the U.S. was completely blindsided by the fall of the Shah and by the emergence of Ayatollah Khomeini. And I think they were embarrassed by the Mubarak and their support for him. And I'm not sure they knew what to do about, and they haven't known what to do since. I mean, this is a situation that the U.S. doesn't control, but everybody seems to think the U.S. does control it. At least that's my analysis.
Well, I think there's a large measure of truth to that. Certainly, Egyptians and Americans, in some cases, give more credit to the United States than it's due. I mean, one of the things that should have become clear in the aftermath of the uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt and Yemen and Libya and Syria and so on is that the United States is not all-powerful and doesn't control the course of events, and people rose up and determined their fates and histories, as it were. Is the United States still important? Does it provide military aid and so on and diplomatic and political cover? Certainly, but is that what's going to determine Mr. Morsi's fate or the fate of the Muslim Brotherhood? Certainly not. It's going to be the Egyptians there, either on the street or participating in elections or other kinds of activism, that are going to determine, I think, the future course of events.
Well, just in closing, Osama Shahada, I take it that it looks as if that Morsi won't be able to get his act together in 48 hours. The opposition certainly aren't going to help. They're going to wait him out, as you pointed out, and the military will intervene and produce a new roadmap. So given what disaster has been so far, maybe it couldn't be worse, right? Maybe there's a way to get it right the next time.
Well, you know, that's one perspective. I mean, I think, as I said, my fear is primarily twofold, right? Is one that this is not a move that further consolidates Egyptian democracy. I mean, we're talking about a non-democratic, non-constitutional intervention that removes a president that was the first president in Egyptian history to be elected by popular will, even if it was only by a slight majority. So And again, I would be on the in the streets in Cairo if I was there on June 30th protesting against Mr. Morsi. But nevertheless, I think that needs to be said. Secondly, and this is quite important as well, getting rid of Mr. Morsi and closing the parliamentary shop dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood is and excluding them from politics is not a recipe for political stability in Egypt, right? I mean, you know, that's not going to lead to, again, consolidated democracy. And in fact, one could argue that from their perspective, they're going to feel that they have had the rug pulled from out of them, that they've participated in democratic elections, won fair and square, and now they're being marginalized by the heavy hand of the military and so on. And that is not a good recipe either. That could lead to the rise of extremism among some of them, the use of violence, and it also certainly doesn't bode well for political stability in Egypt. I mean, it is difficult. It'll be difficult for whoever is in charge to do the overwhelming number of deal with the overwhelming number and magnitude of crises that the country faces, whether it's in terms of restoring security, whether it's in terms of getting the economy going back again, or trying to forge a political process that will include Egyptians forward and that they buy into. So that's a very difficult task.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Sami Shahata.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Sami Shahata, who is a professor of Middle East politics at the University of Oklahoma. He's the author of Shop Floor, Culture and Politics in Egypt, and his most recent book is Islamist Politics in the Middle East, Movements and Change. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back doing an update on the latest on Edward Snowden, who has applied for political asylum in Russia.
Then you win. I heard him say the revolution won't be televised. Al Jazeera proved him wrong. Twitter has him paralyzed. 80 million strong, it ain't no longer gonna be terrorized. Organized, mobilized, vocalized. On the side of truth, from the dunya's living proof that it's a matter of time for the chickens home to roost. Bu Azizi lit the hoof. And it slowly ignited the fire within every people to fight it. From Tunis to Khan Yunis, the new moon shines bright as the man's.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Colleen Rowley, who's a former FBI special agent who investigated Italian organized crime and Sicilian heroin smuggling. In 1990, she transferred to Minneapolis, and in that office, she pushed to investigate the so-called 13th 9/11 hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui. In 2002, she brought some of the pre-9/11 lapses to light and testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee about endemic problems facing the FBI and the intelligence community. Time magazine named her and two other whistleblowers persons of the year. She retired from the FBI in 2004 and now speaks publicly on ethical decision-making and balancing civil liberties with the need for effective investigation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colleen Rowley.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And Edward Snowden applied for political asylum in Russia late on Sunday night at the Russian consulate in the Terminal F of the airport at Moscow, together with Sarah Harrison of WikiLeaks, who was traveling with Mr. Snowden. He had originally was on Ecuadorian documents that were revoked by Ecuador, and of course his passport has been revoked by the United States. What did you make of President Putin's remarks today when he said that if Snowden wants to stay here, there is one condition. He must cease his work aimed at inflicting damage on our American partners, as strange as it may sound from my lips.
Yeah, you're right to laugh because I think he was tongue-in-cheek and is having way too much fun in some respects. It kind of, in a way, reminds me of Ecuador President Correa's comment when he challenged the United States to take human rights training in a way. but I don't think it's serious at all. I don't think he actually means that he wants the United States to keep secrets, you know, from other countries. I'm sure he would be happy, Putin would be happy, if only he and his entourage learned of the secrets.
Well, that's pretty much likely has already happened, hasn't it? I mean, the stuff, the area of the airport where Edward Snowden has been is pretty much controlled by the security people, and they have his bags. That's what happens at airports. And he's got four laptops and a bunch of thumb drives. So,
I don't think that's 100% clear. I suppose it's a 50-50 proposition. It certainly is a strong possibility and maybe even probability. But it depends on how he is personally guarding his own effects. And I don't think anyone really knows. Obviously, it would defeat his purpose in making the information public for the world to know. A lot of his information, I mean, there's been now 2.5 weeks of solid revelation. So certainly, you would kind of think they maybe started with the most important revelations. So a lot of the revelations that he obviously took with him have been made public for the world.
Well, he did. Didn't he give copies, though, of at least, we don't know for sure, but there's, I think, Glenn Greenwald and WikiLeaks, it's probably likely that they got copies of everything he had. I mean, it takes no time to copy a thumb drive, does it?
They're assuring, I think I read somewhere that WikiLeaks is assuring security for the information. So again, I don't know that it's 100% clear that the Russians have gotten a hold of it. You know, what we're talking about here is information is power. That's the key thing here. Information is power, and of course, power corrupts. So the tautology continues. I mean, everyone is you couldn't write a fictional movie with more convoluted turns than what is actually happening in reality.
Well, but what's ironic here, Colleen Rowley, is that Putin is saying, because he's got Obama coming there to visit him in September. His oil revenues are going down because they've so abused their oil infrastructure and not invested in it. And, you know, essentially Putin's popularity has been measured by his ability to deliver to the public, and gas is their main source of income. But they're not reinvesting. And now he's talking about having to bring in Western investors to keep the economy going. So on the one hand, it seems like he's having to pivot to the U.S. He is, after all, a former KGB officer. He's saying, we don't want to upset our American partners anymore by having this drip, drip, drip of information. But that's exactly what WikiLeaks does, right? Drip, drip, drip. So how do you resolve this?
Well, I think the information is seen as, again, it's the treasure here. It's the leverage. And if Putin could use that information, or even the, you know, ostensibly the threat of getting hold of that information to exact other, favors or interest from the United States, I'm sure he would. And you're absolutely right. This is John le Carré. I talked about a novel being written. You know, John le Carré could not have envisioned any more of a convoluted situation. And the number of people who are involved in the intelligence area, obviously Putin came from KGB, but I mean, many of the officials along the lines have served for, certainly in the United States, have served for a portion of their careers in intelligence. So I have to say, this is kind of defying my ability to read between the lines. I think it's one of those things that you have to say, stay tuned. The one area that I think is very important for people to understand, though, is secrecy. And going back to the issues, no matter how the drama unfolds, what the information has revealed thus far is unconstitutional actions of spying on American citizens. There's been no ability by Clapper or Keith Alexander, who are kind of heading this up, to defend this illegal spying, the samples that they gave, the examples that they gave, that this works, that we were able to find terrorists. Well, they have not held water at all once the press was able to see them. The latest revelations about spying on the European Union and upon embassies, well, how can they justify that as saying we're looking for terrorists? Because you're looking for terrorists in embassies and our European allied embassies. I mean, so I think there's been a lot of good to have come so far from the secrecy, defeating the secrecy so far. And I don't know, who knows how it's going to end.
Well, you're absolutely right about Clapper and Hayden. I find just – I think Clapper and Hayden should – if anybody should be put on trial, they should. Hayden, of course, was at NSA and then went on to head up the CIA, and Clapper was with Booz Allen, and now he's a national intelligence guy. And the other guy from NSA, McConnell, is now at Booz Allen, where this Snowden fellow worked. And even though that's not the revelation, and the focus is in the press has been over national security versus civil liberties, my take on it, Colleen, is that what is going on with the privatization of intelligence and this massive influx of money since 9/11, where up to 2/3 of the intelligence budgets now goes to private contractors. I think the real scandal is how much the American taxpayer is being swindled.
And, you know, if you went back to 2010, the Washington Post, a conservative newspaper, had this all in that top secret America series. But without the drama, and of course I'm not trying to justify this convoluted drama that's unraveling, but without the drama, when this article just came out and it was the result of 2 years of research by top investigative writers, you know what? It was like a tree falling in the forest. The people of the country didn't pay attention, and they had that information in there about how much of this was privatized by these contractors that had vested interests and obviously the potential for corruption. Now we're learning, of course, that with all of the hundreds of thousands of people with these clearances, that there's also a potential for them to be I don't believe Edward Snowden is myself, but there would certainly be a potential for a Robert Hansen or an Aldrich Ames to get access to this information and then to actually use it for their own personal profiteering. So you're absolutely right. And this was all out there for about 3 years, but nobody cared or read the Washington Post.
And that was done by Dana Priest and William Arkin. And I've invited William Arkin out to speak here at UCLA Hammer Forum, which I do. He'll be out here on July the 17th. So people here in Los Angeles at least can hear what he has to say. It was a remarkable and prescient study, and it's and again, you know, you feel like this is what we should be learning from Edward Snowden. I mean, the idea that this, you know, my understanding is that he what happens with people like yourself who worked in the FBI and the CIA and other government agencies, they get cleared, they get trained on the taxpayer's dime, and then these private companies poach them, you know, tripling or quadrupling their salaries. And in Snowden's case, he may have gotten up to $200,000, but the contractor then charges the U.S. government $1 million for Snowden's contract.
It's an absolute corrupt system. When Arkin comes, I read this, and you'll have to ask him. I read that he was actually fired from the Washington Post a few months after that story. And you'll have to ask him if that's the case, then why was that the case? Is it because that story really did step on some toes and made some people mad? It's a really good question. I read it, and I'm not, you know, I don't have any way of verifying it, but and maybe he wasn't fired, but maybe his time there had ended and there was nothing for him more to do or something. Who knows? But it's definitely a good question. I think the powers that be are want to guard information, and they really don't realize that it's counterproductive to have that type of excessive secrecy, and that they actually would do far better, not only for democracy, but their own mission would be served if they leveled more, if they, obviously, Clapper and Keith Alexander both lied to Congress about this. they could have found ways to tell the truth. And I just think that this is kind of backfiring in that respect. And hopefully people will realize that secrecy, you know, it's very tempting, I think, when you're in power to want to keep all these secrets, but it's completely wrong and counterproductive.
Well, Colleen, just in the last couple of minutes, when you talk about this story with Edward Snowden as being convoluted and akin to something that John le Carré would write, my sense is that there's going to be a couple of more chapters to this, twists and turns in this story. The president of Ecuador, is in Moscow now. And my understanding is that Maduro, the president of Venezuela, has just got on a plane and he's heading to Moscow, too. So you have two heads of states that have said that they might take in Snowden, and they're talking with Putin. So stay tuned.
I read he's applied for asylum in 15 countries, but there are practical difficulties because of being almost trapped now in this terminal. And so, for instance, Iceland is one of the countries he applied to, but Iceland says you've got to get here first. And of course, Ecuador did revoke the papers. And so I think he's confronted with the fact that he does not have real good options at all. And we'll have, you're absolutely right. We're just going to have to wait and see what happens. And I think that people should realize that the truth of what's going on in this top secret America with all its privatization, and actually counterproductive, to, by the way, to finding terrorists. It's much better to share information. That's what the 9/11 Commission said. If our goal here all along has been to find and stop terrorists, well, this is the worst way of going about it, collecting all this trillions of information on innocent people and cluttering up the databases. And let's hope that there's an outcry. I know 26 senators wrote a letter to Obama, and I would hope that that would be much larger if people understood the real problem that we're facing.
Well, it's also, I think, you know, people like yourself who were trained and to serve the United States government, the idea that we're depleting those resources and these people are being cherry-picked away to make money for companies whose loyalty are to themselves and their shareholders and not to the United States government. Does that bother you?
Well, I think it's the top secret America. What the Washington Post byline was that it's out of control. And I think that it needs to be reined in greatly, both through the law. The laws have been violated, so we need to have some accountability for violating those laws. And then we need to really, I think, get back to how we found terrorists and prosecuted terrorists, not putting innocent people on Guantanamo, not sending people off to black sites and torture, all these really excessive knee-jerk reactions. We need to get back to how we actually deal and control and try to reduce the amount of terrorism in the world. I don't see that. I never see that debate. I mean, I thought for a moment we would have that, but people are distracted by this drama, this personal drama of what will happen to Edward Snowden. I want to talk more on the issues and try to get back to not going bankrupt.
Well, we have to
spending all this money.
We have to wrap up, and I thank you so much for joining us, Colleen Rowley.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Colleen Rowley, who's a former FBI special agent. She was one of the she pushed for the investigation of the so-called 13th 9/11 hijacker and brought the pre-9/11 lapses to light in testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee about endemic problems facing the FBI and the intelligence community. She was named, her and two other whistleblowers were named as Persons of the Year. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Claire Goldsmith and Nick Garino. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.
time.